Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to the World Transformed Archives on Fast Forward Radio. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and I'm pleased to welcome you to this program, which originally aired August 11th, 2009. This is Part 8 of the World Transformed, Part 9 in our rebroadcast series. Sorry if there's been any confusion about the numbering. We simply added one of the preview shows to the count as we put the new archived series together. So if there's been any misunderstanding, this was part 8 of the original series, and it was The End of Scarcity and the Age of Abundance. A terrific discussion, one of our favorite topics at The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio. Great guests, Paul Fernhout, Joseph Jackson, and our own Sally Morim, our chat host. Those of you who participate in the chat room know Sally and know her views on a lot of these issues. Just a terrific discussion about what happens in a world where material goods are increasingly commoditized to the point where poverty no longer exists, a world in which everyone is essentially rich. There are ways of getting to such a world. There are arguments that such a world is inevitable, and there are arguments that we will never achieve such a world. So those issues are explored in depth, one of our favorite topics here, something I think you'll benefit from listening to, and something that we'll be exploring in the future on Fast Forward Radio and The World Transformed. Monday evening, we're dipping into the archives of Fast Forward Radio for an interview we did with Dave Goebel back in November of 2007. Dave, as you know, is the co-founder of the Methuselah Mouse Prize, and his perspectives on issues related to life extension and other futurist-related topics always fascinating. We'll be on live Wednesday night with a brand new show. And 1 week from tonight, we will be back on with the World Transformed Archives talking about the technological singularity, and that is part 9 of our series, talking with Mr. Singularity himself, Mr. Ray Kurzweil. So you'll not want to miss that program. That's one of the biggest shows we ever did. Well, I hope you enjoy all of our upcoming programs, and I hope you enjoy The End of Scarcity and The Age of Abundance, which starts right now. And until next time, live to see it. Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm excellent.
All right. Well, I'm very excited about the show that we have tonight. This is one of the 10 that I've been especially looking forward to ever since we talked about this. When was that? Probably March of this year, is that right? Maybe a little earlier, sometime earlier this year.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to this series and kind of building up to it for a while, and this is going to be one of the fun ones.
Yeah, this is
no
this
doubt.
This is a terrific topic, and speaking of terrific, we've got our terrific chat host with us, Michael Darling. Hello, Michael.
Good evening.
have you found your way into the chat room yet?
I have. In fact, we were joking before the show about how hard it is to do comedy in chat, but I think I could develop a Dr. Nick personality in the chat room.
Well, we're going to let you work on that tonight, and you can report back at the end of the program. Let us know how that went, okay?
Will do.
And good luck, chatters. We've got Michael / Dr. Nick to deal with this. Hope that works out for you. Okay, well, Stephen, I think that our topic this evening, post-scarcity, this is going to be a great show. I suggest we go ahead and bring on our panel.
No doubt. Let's start with Paul Fernhout. Paul, did I pronounce your last name correctly?
Yeah, perfectly.
great. He writes essays about future-oriented themes, including post-scarcity, which is nice to, since considering the topic of tonight's show. He does free and open-source software development and shares homeschooling duties with his wife, Cynthia. And Paul, I'm going to need to visit with you on that subject because I started homeschooling my four kids with my wife. So
terrific.
So, anyway, welcome, Paul.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. You guys are doing a great public service, making all this information available to people so they can think about it. It's wonderful.
Thanks, Paul. That's what we're about. We want to get this out here. There is a tremendous opportunity, I think, if people know about some of these topics, and there's this kind of dawning, emerging awareness, and if we're playing a small role in that, that's very encouraging. Well, our second guest is returning to Fast Forward Radio. He's Joseph Jackson. He's a philosopher and social entrepreneur, a graduate of Harvard College and the London School of Economics, and he leads the Network for Open Scientific Innovation, which is a 501c3 organization which seeks to promote the emergence of open source models in the life sciences. Joseph, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you.
Excellent. Sally Morham writes essays on science fiction, political philosophy, and the future of technology, including the problems with linear projections of the future, Yes, the World is Round, Nanotechnology Explained, and The Magic Universe of George Lucas. Welcome back. Well, welcome, Sally.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed listening to your show for almost a year now.
Excellent.
I really enjoy high-tech stuff and futuristic stuff ever since I've been a space activist in the 1980s.
Awesome.
Well, now, you should have mentioned the space activist credentials in your bio. We would have put that up on the
Yeah, I guess I should, but I didn't
up on the web,
realize though. That.
Sally is an inspiration, I hope, to everyone participating in the chat room because she is a devoted listener and participant in Blog Talk Radio. And if you participate in the show, look what happens. Eventually, maybe you become a guest on the program. So I'm not guaranteeing that to everyone, but Sally is a shining beacon to the rest of you in the chat room. Okay, so
she's also blogging with us now some too as well. So
she does blog at an obscure little blog called The Speculist from time to time. That's right.
She's, yes, I do.
Just the American dream right here. Okay, so let's kick it off. We're going to do our world transform questions. And I believe we'll start with Joseph, just pick right out of the middle of the intro. So Joseph, I've got two questions for you. One, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime? And then what is the greatest transformation of our world that you expect to witness in your lifetime, if different from the previous answer?
Okay, well, see, I am now 27, so I guess, the representative thing that I will cite is the Napster revolution. That's just been a sort of, one of those things where you always remember where you were, when it happened. So, to me, it sort of represented this, that we had reached this, potential, phase shift. So I saw what could be possible with digital media, and it got me thinking about all these other ideas and how they might follow a similar P2P trajectory. So that is and of course it's enabled by the internet, which would be the obvious main technology that everyone probably is going to cite. And then
Napster created a real model of post scarcity for music, didn't it? I mean, it kind of introduced that idea for the music world in a sense.
Right. Yes. Well, getting rid of that distribution bottleneck, so then I expect, of course, a lot of really far out things to happen, hopefully in my lifetime, where I'll be able to benefit from them. But I would cite possibly the convergence of life logging with ubiquitous computing. That's going to be what I think of as a sociological singularity, at which point we have no real privacy anymore. This changes the entire way that we will all interact with one another and power dynamics.
Give us the 25 words or less on
that. Yeah, right. Sorry. Yes. Yeah, so life logging plus personal manufacturing capability, anti-aging, all of the above.
Well, sure, but I just meant, what is life logging, just for those who aren't
familiar? Okay, I love life logging. So if the idea that, and just like our Facebook and Twitter now, that's a crude first-generation example of that. Life logging has been around, practiced by such wearable computing advocates as Steve Mann, since the 1980s. And he actually videoed and backed up, lots of his, everyday occurrences, sort of a form of digital memory and also a personal security record. And so essentially integrating that with a reputation system so that, everything that we do, all our social interactions are indexed. I think that's going to be probably the most transformative thing for social relations.
Absolutely. That could be huge. Absolutely. That could be huge. Just a complete record of everything we do. Okay, Stephen, who's next?
Well, let's go with Paul. Paul, what do you think is the greatest transformation of our world that you've witnessed in your lifetime? And then what do you think you're going to live to see?
Well, I'm very tempted to say something like the Internet, especially in relation to Moore's Law. But the one thing is, I think it was Neal Stephenson who said something like, the future is here already. It's just unevenly distributed. So in college in the early 80s, I was using the Internet. I was using FTP sites to download software and run it. I was using news groups on Usenet and such, and a little bit of email. And I was running that on Unix. And here, 25, 27 years later, I'm using Unix. I'm doing email. I'm downloading software. So although it's completely true, I agree with the rest of the people who say it's a fantastic thing and it's changed a lot. As far as what I've seen, except for maybe a dip in the middle, there's a lot that was available 25 years that's available now to me personally. But there is one thing that has really changed for me, and that's actually printing, which I don't think anybody's mentioned yet. I listened to some of your previous episodes.
That's right. Nobody's mentioned that.
For me, when I was in college, I was an undergraduate. Actually, I transferred to Princeton University, and I was also working at the computer center there, kind of as a work study student. And at the time, this was around 1982, 1983, they were very proud that they got one and then two laser printers in the computer center. And
yeah,
these were very big beasts. I mean, they were, the size of big refrigerators laid on their side. And they could put out pages, fairly quickly by those standards, certainly, much nicer than line printers because you could do 300 dpi roughly, something like that, on them. And, they were new, they were exciting, they were probably $25,000 or $30,000 a piece. And, back then, the dollar was worth probably twice as much as it is now. So for those two, together, let's say, $50,000, $60,000 times two, $120,000, the price of a small house, like in a rural area, for those two laser printers. And they were attached to this IBM mainframe that was also very, very expensive. And when I was learning how to use them and send stuff to them, at first nobody knew they were there. And so you could send stuff, you could print out your college term papers and stuff. But over a year or two, everybody realized they were there and they were really nice output. And so this kind of queue formed. And at some point, someone made this piece of software and you could find out how long it would take your printout to show up. And at some point, it was like 2 days, 3 days, that you submit and before you actually get it through there. Because everybody wanted the nice output as opposed to the line printer output. And actually, when I printed my senior thesis, my final paper, as it were, at Princeton, everybody writes one, or almost everybody writes one to graduate undergrad. This queue had been so long that I knew I couldn't, I was working till the last minute there, and I knew I couldn't put my paper through there. So I ended up using a kind of Selectric printer that was in what they called the ready room there, and you had to bring your own ribbon and put in your own paper. And so I did that, and that's how I did my copy of my thesis on that, even though the laser printer was there. So if we can now fast forward 25 years later to about a year or two ago for me, I was in actually an Apple store buying a Mac after 5 years of using Debian GNU/Linux. I decided, let me try something different. Also, I wanted something quiet and something with 8 cores, so, a fancier computer. And so after I make my computer selection, and I'm there with my kid and I'm kind of tired, and the the guy there offers me a printer. And we have mostly one kind of brand of printer. It was a different kind of brand of printer. He said it was like maybe $100 with a rebate. So it was basically free if I wanted to fill in the paperwork. But, you know, I thought my hands would be full taking the computer home, and I have my kid with me and all this stuff. And so I said, no, I don't want it. You know, I have printers at home already. I don't want another kind of printer. I mean, yeah. But that particular printer that I said I don't want probably was as powerful, you know, and as capable and better than those two laser printers that cost a house, you know, 25, 27 years ago.
Wow.
You know, it was color. For another $100, you could get a scanner with it. And the thing is, I didn't want it.
Too much trouble to carry it home.
Too much trouble to take it home. And also, that particular printer probably had more computer power than the IBM mainframe that was being, you know, serviced by 20 or 40 people, you know, in this big computer center. You know, had more computing power than, you know, what I learned to program C programming in way back when. So, you know, I wasn't interested in it because I had a lot and I had other things to do, like focus on my kid and focus on other tasks that I was interested in and not have as much clutter in my life as one more printer that I didn't really need anymore. So I think that that's been a huge change that I've kind of seen personally, you know, as far as feeling that I have enough printers to go around. Now, as far as the future, now, right now, you can go and buy a 3D printer. You know, Jay Leno just did something on Popular Mechanics with a video, and he showed them using a 3D printer. I think it was about $15,000. It was actually a lower-end one, even though there are much cheaper ones like RepRap and Fab at Home that are only like a couple thousand assembled. But this one was like $15,000. It had a $3,000 laser scanner. He showed scanning a car part and then printing out a part and then doing other things with it and how they could send it to other people to have it cast in metal and do things like that. And there are 3D printers you can get now for like $50,000 that are really nice, that can print in parts in color. And basically you get things out of there that are actually multicolored, and you can get things printed out. They're essentially assembled that have multiple moving parts. There are now 3D printers, again, in that higher price range that can print two different types of materials. So one can be a little elastic, so you can print a hairbrush or a stapler, things like that. There are ones now that can print in metal. And again, they're all, you know, just the really good ones that are easy to use and they have expensive cartridges, but they're in this $50,000 price range. So I'm really thinking that in another 25 years, I'll be in some store somewhere, if stores still exist, and somebody will be saying, here's this, you know, almost free with a rebate, 3D printer that can print, you know, another 3D printer, or, you know, a book, or a, you know, bottle of water maybe, or a computer disk drive, and I'll be like, no, I don't want it.
I got one at home.
I got two at home. I got five at home. I'm not interested.
You know what I love about that, Paul, is the qualifier, if stores still exist.
They may not. You know, if you can print stuff at home in 3D, it's, you know, it may change the entire dynamics of supply chains and everything in our society, as well as a lot of things that go with it. I'm sure you're going to get into medical care and how this might affect it, but, you know, all these projections now for, like, Social Security and for Medicare, you know, where it's going to be in 25 years, these technologies can totally change all those issues about how much money people need, about how much health care is going to cost, and so forth.
Okay, great. And we will give you a chance to talk more about that, too, but we want to, lest we forget, let Sally have a shot at the two World Transform questions. So what's it going to be, Sally? What's the big transformation you've seen, and what do you expect to see going forward?
Now, since I was born during the Korean War, I either have a great advantage over you guys or a disadvantage in picking a really key technology. I was scribbling down here, well, computers when I was born were the monster size that filled entire office buildings. Space hadn't even begun yet. Sputnik occurred 5 years after I was born. The Internet was fantastic. I love it. Let's see, what about personal computers? I decided on personal computers because, as a writer, they completely changed my life. Speaking of printing and publishing, I'm able to do that myself. I've never been the world's greatest typist, and the delete key is my good friend on my keyboard here.
Absolutely.
And what else? Oh, that I mentioned here that I noticed I can't remember which of our fellow panelists mentioned life logging. I read about Ralph Waldo Emerson, who lived in the 19th century. He was probably the world's greatest life logger. He had over 200 notebooks on his life, on his readings, his writings, his experiences, and it's pulled from every one of those every time he had to write something. So I nominate Emerson as a singularitarian.
How much Emerson would have loved Twitter, huh? He would have been willing to...
He would have been into that.
For me, personal computers, of course, they led straight to the Internet. We had the ARPANET before the Internet, and that was for the big mainframers, the programmers for them. But for us, we got the Internet when we got our personal computers. So that's my nomination for the greatest invention that changed lives in my life since I was born. Now, for the future, I read Eric Drexler, and I actually met him twice in the 80s when I was a space activist. I read his book about nanotechnology, The Engines of Creation, heard him give his talks in nanotechnology, and I realized it would work because it, something like it already works. It's called life. So I'm sticking with nanotechnology. I think this is just going to turn everything upside down, and related to the topic we're discussing tonight, it will lead straight to the abundant society with all without all the little finagling about politics and all the other things that will do it. It'll be the technology that will lead us there. I'm absolutely convinced of it. All the other things that we've been discussing, robotics, life extension, it will all grow out of nanotechnology. That's my prediction. So those are my two answers to the question.
Okay, very nice. Well, I think nice rounding out of the topics between the guests. I enjoyed all the answers. And Sally, your comments kind of lead us into our first question. So I'm gonna kick this one off with you. And stepping away from nanotechnology, that is to say, not necessarily having to go to nanotechnology, but just generally speaking, how is scarcity eliminated, and how does abundance happen? Because we're looking at this world in which Paul gave this great, awesome story about how what a few years ago cost a fortune is now so disposable that you wouldn't even bother to pick it up, and it probably doesn't weigh that much anymore either. So, I mean, it's amazing the transformation in value and in economy related to those to printing. And I think we could Joseph had talked about in music, and I think we could and will get into a lot of other areas. But generally speaking, how does that happen? What makes that happen? What drives that?
Well, before the show, I was scribbling down some notes on how I think we will go from our scarce societies, everything that we have now in the world is scarce, including America, comparatively. We're dirt poor compared to the society we're dreaming of here. I believe that a number of accelerating technologies have been going on, probably since the Stone Age. They're just really picking up now in the 19th and 20th centuries when everyone started really noticing them. And now in the 21st century, I believe what's driving it all is three aspects of technology ever since the Stone Age. Things get smaller, things get more precise, and things get more easily copied. And this happens faster and faster and faster. You can see how that ties into nanotechnology and the other technologies we're discussing. So as the crude present-day technologies get transformed into more powerful and effective ways of managing these, the information flow, or data flow, as Greg Bear, the science fiction writer, called it, as that happens, more and more information is able to be processed and sent around, and people who need it can get it, and that generates more and more and more. It's all self-catalyzing. It's almost like the explosion metaphor. I believe that's what's driving everything, is those three things, getting smaller, getting more precise, and getting more easily copied.
Okay, so smaller, more precise, and more easily copied. And obviously, nanotech would then be the ultimate example of getting smaller. Okay, let me pass that on back to Paul. Would you concur that it's those three factors, or do you see something else as being the primary driver behind the elimination of scarcity and the emergence of abundance?
I think those factors that Sally mentioned are very important, and I really think that they are happening in a lot of ways in our society. But with that said, I think that there are things holding back general abundance for everybody. Basically, there are, you could call them artificial scarcities that people have created for all sorts of reasons. And I think that as we kind of mature as a society, we will start looking at these artificial scarcities and try to eliminate them and bring true abundance to everybody. For example, Albert Einstein had this kind of famous quote where he says, "The release of atom power has changed everything except our way of thinking. The solution to this problem lies in the heart of mankind. If I had only known, I would have become a watchmaker." Of course, watchmakers nowadays are making these digital wireless connected watches that do all kinds of amazing things that have other issues related to them and artificial scarcity, like they might have digital rights management in them and things like that. But
it just kind of freaks me out to think that people still make watches.
Well, they'll be printing them soon if they aren't already.
It's pretty amazing when you think about it.
So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But the point here about this is the sense that while, you know, all the trends that Sally identified are really happening, but there are these kind of counter trends. And this is one example with Albert Einstein. He talked about the power of the atom, you know, which can be used in a variety of ways. You know, it's used in medical technology. It's used for X-rays. It's used for treating cancer. You can use it for atomic energy, even though personally I'm a solar energy fan. You can use it for a variety of things, but you can also use it to destroy a lot of things. And it's more than the issue of you can use it for good or evil. It's more this issue that Albert Einstein raised of there's sort of almost an irony in our thinking about it, because if you can produce vast amounts of abundance, either abundant health or abundant energy or abundant space travel or other things with that, then why should you be going around blowing people up with it, fighting over oil or something else that, you know, that atomic energy in this context renders not so important? And I think we can look at technology after technology in our society and see that kind of irony in all sorts of ways. An example of irony, just by the way, which I love, is Rod Serling. I mean, I love it because it's ironic, although it's very sad that it happened. And this is one of the reasons I think Rod Serling started getting involved in the Twilight Zone, which I love those programs. There was a lot of irony in those programs. But he was in a platoon, I think it was around World War II or one of the other 100 wars that the United States has had. And what was happening to the platoon is they were starving. They weren't supplied. They were running out of food. And so an airplane flew overhead and dropped them some food. But something went wrong, like it was dropped in the wrong place or the parachute didn't open. And so his best buddy, who was standing next to him, got this huge crate of food right on top of him, boom,
killing him.
Which is very sad, but it's also terribly, terribly ironic. Here was this food that was going to save him, and instead he was destroyed by it. And for me, I find that this irony is very central to how we approach so many of these technologies, whether it's robotics or biotechnology or artificial intelligence, that we have a chance here as a society to take these technologies and do amazing and amazing things with them. But we really have to look at them from this perspective of trying to get all those things that Sally mentioned out of them, this smaller, more precise, more easily copied, faster, and do them for everybody rather than end up fighting over things and making smaller weapons or more precise weapons and fighting more and more with them. So I think we kind of have a societal choice, but it's more than just good or evil. It's kind of like one way is sort of stupid, you know, to take these technologies of abundance and fight over old-fashioned problems, you know, like Albert Einstein said, old, you know, things that relate to our old way of thinking. So I think the deepest thing about how scarcity is going to be eliminated is this change in our thinking to just allow us to take all these things that we already have and do really good things with them.
Okay, so it's a combination. So we'll start with we'll start with the formulation Sally gave us, a technological motion, a drive in a certain direction in terms of things getting smaller, things getting more precise, things getting easier to copy. But over and above that, it's a change in how people think. And I love the Rod Serling story. I have to say, I've never heard that before. And amazing what an impact that event must have had on him. Because essentially then he just kept telling different versions of that story for the rest of his life, right? I mean, we never saw that exact one, but that's an amazing story. Okay, Joseph?
Wait.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Sure. I think Paul has a phrase, something like the central challenge of the 21st century is post-scarcity technologies in the hands of people that still have a scarcity mindset or something like that. I don't know if his exact phrasing. Is that correct, Paul?
That's good enough. Yeah, that's great.
I would largely agree that most of the problem now is psychological and sociological. There's been a recent dust-up of sorts with Peter Thiel and some other futurists taking issue with some things that he had put out in the media, and then...
Okay, full disclosure, I am a minor player in that.
Yeah, I saw your comment on that as well. And then Jamais, Cassio weighed in as well.
Yes.
Warning us about the delusion of the end of politics. And that might be a good topic to do in depth sometime as well. But I would kind of take issue a little bit with what he's saying. I don't think that, nanotech is not going to just magically solve the problems for us, right? You probably are familiar with the Diamond Age, obviously famous work by Neal Stephenson, and they have this sort of neo-Victorian society in which the source, is controlled, and people only have access to the feed, and there are only certain designs, things are approved for you to manufacture. So, obviously that type of scenario could play out. I personally think that it is a noble goal to try to transcend politics as long as we recognize that technology itself is inherently political and the development of it is influenced by all sorts of political forces. So we need to be very cognizant of that and really speaks to the importance of open source as a development methodology. It's really the only example so far and that we have of a way of sort of settling differences around how technology is going to be deployed that allows groups to fork, sort of take the project in their own direction if there's an irreconcilable difference. It also ensures the customizability of the technological platform in question to the needs of local users. I think that's got to be the prominent model for nanotech and every other emerging technology.
I'm sorry, say that again. Takes the local users?
Well, the open source guarantees the freedom of anyone to essentially fork the project, right, and also prevents lock-in and ensures that people have the ability to customize things for their own local needs. Right? And so that's the kind of the big... We have all sorts of examples just from consumer electronics, such as Betamax versus VHS, USB, even AC versus DC power, right? And always the battle over standards throughout the history of technology, right?
Just last year, it was Blu-ray versus HD DVD, right?
It gets repeated again and again, and companies and different players, obviously, when they accumulate disproportionate power, they're able to influence the rules of the game. Famously, of course, Microsoft being the biggest offender of this. And so if we end up having that type of innovation system, ecosystem for innovation, leading up to these new synthetic biology, nanotechnology, robotics, we may survive, the VHS from being an inferior standard. Perhaps that's not the end of the world, but it very well could be for a shoddy implementation of the nanotech replicator control system and whatnot, right? And so even if it's a small probability of that magnified by the consequences, right? This to me is
you want to get it right, yeah.
The central sort of issues is how technology will be governed. I definitely think that we can transcend politics as it has been practiced for the past hundreds of years as essentially a battling over distribution of resources, scarce resources. So you'll have a different type of politics, perhaps more sort of these schools of philosophy and music and aesthetics, where there can be very passionate disagreements over what position or school is correct, but people are not killing one another.
Yeah, maybe we can all be more or less friends. Wouldn't that be nice? Or at least just not be screaming at each other all the time. That would be a nice way to implement politics, I think. Given a choice, I'd like to see it go in a direction like that. So it sounds like we've got three very distinct answers, and I liked all three. A practical technological trend, set of trends from Sally, a philosophy from and kind of a statement about human psychology from Paul, and then the practical what do we do about politics from Joseph. All three playing a role in what it is that drives this movement away from scarcity and towards abundance. So let's shift gears a little bit, and Stephen, let's talk a little bit about where ideas of post-scarcity can be applied.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about education then, because I'll put it to you this way. We have just started homeschooling my four kids, and there's absolutely no way that we would have attempted this except for the fact that we can very cheaply put a laptop in front of each of them and have them and have computer classes for each of them at their individual levels. There's no possibility that my wife and I could provide them with an education at each of their four levels, except for doing something like this. And so, I guess my question, I'm going to direct this first to you, Paul, since you're a homeschooler as well, is does the abundance paradigm take over education? Are some of these technologies going to revolutionize education, not just for homeschoolers, but for kids everywhere?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wrote a little essay related to that once about essentially how educational technology has failed schools, and the title was a joke, meaning that the schools were actually the ones that were getting the failing grade. And the reason for that is exactly what you mentioned, that educational technology through computers makes possible on-demand education as opposed to just-in-case education. And so much of schooling in particular is just-in-case. You know, you need to learn the capital of Arkansas, just-in-case. Now, it may be very important to you if you live there. It may be very important in all kinds of other situations. But if you can look it up, not to say anything bad about that state, probably for most people, if it's available when they need it, they'll find it. But if you spend, a large amount of time drilling all these state capitals into a kid when they're not interested, it might take you days and days and days to do this. And that's time that a kid could spend learning something else that they were interested in. Like, let's say they were interested in learning the lines of Shakespeare or something like that. They might actually learn those really well because that's what they care about. And similar, the other way goes. There might be some kid who loves geography, but he's being forced to learn Shakespeare, not on his schedule and or her schedule. And that can be a real problem, and that's one reason that a lot of homeschooling is so much more effective, that a kid can learn so much more quickly, both from one-on-one interaction with parents or tutors or other homeschoolers, from these resources that you mentioned on the computer, and kids can learn much more quickly a variety of things. And so their pattern of learning changes, and you get sometimes more diversity of learning, but also you may get better learning sometimes when kids are very motivated to learn a particular thing. And there's a variety of homeschooling strategies. There's ranging from kind of school at home, which often a lot of people start off with, trying to kind of duplicate the classroom at home, the classroom methods, all the way to unschooling, which is kind of a very more free-ranging thing. And a lot of people end up in the middle. Marshall Brain has on his site one thing about how homeschooling works. It's a great little essay with a lot of ideas about different possibilities. So anyway, in general, I think you're right. This computer revolution, really, which we haven't even necessarily seen yet, according to Alan Kay. He wrote an essay called "The Computer Revolution Hasn't Happened Yet," and Doug Engelbart has written something as well about had a whole colloquium called "The Unfinished Revolution" that I took part in around 2000. And so there.
What finishes the revolution, Paul?
Well, it's not clear. But the whole idea is that computers really haven't been integrated into our society as much as a lot of people can imagine they could be.
Yeah.
And this aspect of education is a very important one.
I was thinking that you might say that once kids in struggling countries have access to this technology, then we will see something.
Well, I think there's a few different trends. I think that is very important. Although, actually, one thing about putting computers in the hands of people in other countries is that information flows two ways. And there's a lot of really great ideas and cultures that people have developed in other places that it would be great if the Internet was kind of infused with them. All sorts of different ideas about sharing, different ways of resolving conflicts, different ways of viewing the universe. That could all be possible. And so that would be another thing to learn about as more and more people come online in a variety of cultures that haven't really been that Internet connected yet. I do think that there's another counter trend, though, in education, and it's computers right now are being, and have been for a long time, resisted in the classroom, precisely because they have this ability to allow people to learn on demand instead of on a very structured schedule. And if John Taylor Gatto is one of my favorite authors. He was New York State Teacher of the Year in 1991, and he resigned then and wrote this big article in the New York Times about how he wasn't going to hurt kids anymore. That's what he said as a teacher. He wanted a different profession almost, and he became a lecturer about a lot of these ideas. And basically what he said is, cutting a long, long story short, is that modern schooling was invented in Prussia. It was actually, I shouldn't say invented, it was refined. It came out of roots going back to Plato. But basically the idea is to create a very hierarchical state with very obedient people who really learn what they're told and follow orders, and maybe having a very small elite on top of that who might be more creative or able to do some things. But the bulk of everybody was supposed to be just very compliant, either as soldiers or workers or consumers. And that is what the model of schooling that we still have 150 years later is set up to do. But it's totally out of sync with our society. It may have made sense 150 years ago when factories were a very different way than they are now. When army, even the military now says that they want creative, people who can solve problems, very difficult problems oftentimes in peacekeeping and a variety of things. So our education is really out of sync with that, and in that sense, schooling and education are two totally different things. And so one thing I see happening is schooling will either wither away or it will transform very much to embrace these technologies and change how it works, and maybe even expand, because in a way, schooling itself is creating a scarcity of knowledge, that you can only go to certain schools. Let's say almost every community has a local school, but the only people who can really go to it are generally, let's say during school hours, are people in certain age ranges for certain specific purposes. They're not general community learning centers, more like libraries. And while a lot of communities have libraries, they don't have the kind of resources that schools have. They aren't as big. They don't have a lot of staff who've been trained in a lot of different things or have a lot of different resources. So I can imagine that as this computer revolution, if one wants to call it, or other things progress, one will see more and more learning centers, more and more schools thinking about changing how they work into community learning centers. I wrote a related essay about that called Towards a Post-Scarcity New York State of Mind. And one thing I mentioned there is New York State has one of the most expensive amounts of money they spend per kid on schooling. It's around $20,000 a year per child on average. That's a lot of money per kid per year. And you don't get that if you're a homeschooler. You only get that if you decide to put your kid into school and learn, the particular school's way. And one thought is that, I don't say this is going to happen anytime soon, but if that money, let's say, went directly to the parents and they could decide how to spend it, whether to spend it on tutoring or other things, I think we would see a complete change in how education was happening, because there would be a variety of plans. All the current teachers who are stuck in a certain standard way of teaching would have the ability to offer services to people who would finally be able to afford them, you know, and a lot of parents would have the option of homeschooling because suddenly they'd have a much larger income at home. And this may be a topic I might talk about later, but there's a lot of ideas in abundance thinking that relate to having a basic income. In order to actually make the market function where everybody, especially as automation takes over more and more jobs, so the idea would be that everybody gets sort of a basic level of income they can spend in the market so the market hears their needs. And this is one way to approach it, at least with money that's already currently taken and sent towards children, but to think about how to change that resource so it's no longer, that money is no longer going to this obsolete 150-year-old model of make kids fit into an industrial economy that we don't have anymore, but instead figure out a way to spend it through the marketplace, through other means, so that kids are really able to function in the 21st century in a really positive way, not just struggling against all these trends, but able to surf them and ride with them. So I'm really hopeful that those things may happen eventually. But again, it's this shift of paradigm. And that's why I love your radio show, because, you know, it's helping that along. And that's really wonderful.
Well, one of the things we often talk about is this. Sorry to step on you there, Steve.
No, sorry.
We're going to jump in and talk about the idea of deindustrialization, because I think that is so key to so many of the transformations that we're looking at, and particularly to the move to post scarcity. Effectively, when Joseph was talking about the elimination of the old distribution model for music, that was the deindustrialization of music. We have deindustrialized radio, right? So we're able to, you know, with a couple of laptops and a couple of internet connections, we're able to do a radio show. When you talk about all these different aspects of our lives that can be reworked out without that overarching paradigm of the Industrial Revolution, you start to see some really interesting potential models emerge. Now, one other thing I wanted to say before, I know Stephen wants to pass the same question on to the others, is your notion of taking that $20,000 and paying it directly to the parents. I got to thinking, well, since you know you could homeschool for a lot less than $20,000, Stephen, I know you're not, you know, probably not spending $80,000 right now on the kids. I hope, but since it can be done for a lot cheaper than that, maybe we could take a big chunk of that $20,000 and use some of that money to educate people elsewhere in the world. One of the things you wrote, Paul, that I was really intrigued by, and we don't have a lot of time to spend on it, was just this comparison of all the money spent on everyone going to the elite schools would equal about the same amount that it would take to educate about 1 billion kids worldwide using a computer-driven homeschool kind of a method.
Right. That was one kind of estimate I do. Sometimes I just make these kind of, out there estimates, and I looked at just thinking the top 50 schools, how much they spend in 1 year, basically, for, you know, one class year going through there, and it was about the cost to buy one laptop per child computers for about, assuming kids share them somewhat, about 1 billion kids. So, and actually the same thing's true for Princeton University. If you just dissolved it and took the endowment, $15 billion or something, and then the cost of the physical plan, and again, that would be enough to buy the bottom billion kids in the world. One laptop per child thing is about $100 a piece. So in some sense, you know, these institutions that we have are costing us, you know, global education. Now, I think that we do have enough resources to have both. But it's the reason I put it out isn't to say that we should dissolve Princeton or that the top 50 schools should shut down or anything like that. It's just to say that we're making
which is just as well, because that's not going to happen, right?
Well, I mean, but you know, it's to say that these institutions justify themselves, saying that they are lighting up the world. You know, that they are helping everybody. And so I think if you look at this and you say, well, there's 1 billion people going ignorant for these few schools, you know, maybe they should try harder, you know, to help these kids at the bottom. And there are a lot of people who are helping. I don't want to say people aren't. There's a lot of wonderful individuals. But structurally, they're not. You know, as institutions, it's not their mission to do these kind of things. And so it's just interesting to think about how there are so many resources that we can deploy in a lot of different ways. And the thing is, right now our global economy is roughly $60 trillion a year, which is a lot of money per year. So, you know, there's a lot of money to go around to solve all these problems. And as Sally mentioned, things keep getting smaller and cheaper. And so this is going to get an easier and easier problem to solve. And it would be nice, you know, it's nice that more and more people think about it. And a lot of people are. So that's all very positive, that there are all these groundswells of trends. Paul Hawken wrote this book called Blessed Unrest about all these disconnected people are trying to do all these amazing things. And so that's all a very, very positive set of trends about people trying to help.
Well, I have to say how impressed I am to have read that idea from you. Let's get laptops into the hands of a billion kids worldwide, and they can and that's a good model for educating them, to learn that the man who wrote that is using computers at home to teach his own kids. None of this, you know, good enough for thee but not for me kind of approach, that you really do see that as the right model. I think that's very impressive.
It's the beginning of a model. Now I think there's a lot of things you want to do with kids besides computers. You know, I think computers are especially more useful for older kids. At a younger age, for example, for our kid, you know, it's playing in the sandbox, it's doing stuff with water, it's looking at nature, you know, interacting with people. The computer is part of it. But, you know, there is this whole larger aspect. And even for those proposals, one laptop per child, you know, in the hands of kids or an equivalent computer, you know, that would be part of a larger thing, ideally. So you know, you don't want kids sucked into the computer too much, but it can be a rich part of a larger effort.
Absolutely. Okay, well let's stick with this topic of education. And Sally, I'm gonna take it over to you now. I want to talk a little bit about keeping with Stephen's question about the transformation of education in post-scarcity. One of the interesting things that's happened over the last few years is MIT started offering basically their entire course catalog online for free, which is an astounding thing when you think about it. You talk about these elite schools, and as Paul was just saying, their mission to light up the world and to provide knowledge to the world. Well, MIT is taking that very seriously and providing basically all of the knowledge that you can get from their courseware for free over the internet for anyone who wants to take it. And if you go to the site and read about it, one of the things that they're very clear about right up front is that you're never going to get an MIT degree, right, using their open courseware. They're not going to grant degrees or certificates. You're not going to get to talk to the faculty. It's not an MIT education. So my question is, does a new model of abundance in anything, and education is our example right now, also create opportunities for new kinds of scarcity? Because it seems to me that what MIT has declared in doing this is that they're not in the business of selling knowledge. They're in the business of selling diplomas that have MIT stamped on them. So what's the relationship, say, in education or any other example you'd want to give, between abundance and new forms of scarcity?
Well, education. Consider the old system was based on the old technology, 19th century. Take the Germans, for example. The idea is you send all the kids who are bright enough to a certain city and have them learn from these professors who have painfully amassed information, and then send them out again to engage their lives, which is pretty much how education goes today. The reason that worked that way is that information was, like I said, very hard to gather, and it was even more difficult to disseminate. It was much easier to go physically to the source, learn it, write it down in your notebooks. That's pretty much how they learned. They didn't really engage in discourse with their professors, and then go out and do whatever they needed to do with the information. Now, with the internet and lots of other technologies, this has been turned upside down, and a whole lot of schools and teachers and educators are behind the curve here. And as we move towards a genuine abundance society, this will become even more obsolete, this old system. Imagine right now we have billions of web pages out there. Imagine when we have trillions of web pages on any subject you want, including every detail of those MIT courses, And anyone who wants to learn them and not necessarily get the sheepskin, they can learn them and then they can put them to use in their lives. I'm imagining a society that's far more advanced than has been discussed so far, one where nanotechnology has completely swamped the economy. I am a free marketer. I freely admit this. I believe this is the way, the best way we can manage scarcity to this extent today. And I believe it's leading to this abundant society when everything gets overthrown, when everything becomes so decentralized that you don't have to beg for permission to use a technology. You just go out and replicate it and use it. Now, for education, this becomes quite easy. What you do is everyone basically homeschools. That's the way I'm imagining it. And for really obscure courses, they go online and they perhaps form voluntary classes or discussion groups or whatever they need to do to learn the material. The material is what drives it. Now, what kind of scarcities can you imagine when there's a society where people are all growing their own everything, their own houses, their own appliances, their own food in the replicators, say the Star Trek replicators for the fun of it? What happens then? What kind of scarcities can you imagine? I'm thinking the only kind of scarcity that would exist then wouldn't be the MIT sheepskin. Very few people would care about that, or maybe wouldn't even exist anymore. I think the only scarcity I can think of in a truly abundant society is prestige. Who is known as that great artist in such and such a school of art? Who is known as the great scientist in the advanced astrophysics field of such and such? Who is the great inventor in femtotechnology? And so on. That's where the scarcity will be. The rest, from what I could understand of the discussion so far, it sounds like very near-term proposals for changes that will get us to a little bit closer to abundance. But it doesn't sound like abundance to me. Abundance to me sounds like when everyone can basically do what they want. It would be basically what I'm describing is the dreams of socialists achieved through high-tech libertarian means.
Okay, well, you're crowding our final 30 minutes here, Sally. You're, jumping ahead. That's okay. I know you're eager to get to it, but we're gonna stick on education just long enough for Joseph to get to get to respond. What do you think, Joseph, about the idea?
I've got a bunch of stuff stored up on this. Okay. First of all, schooling and especially higher education now are one of the biggest culprits of the imposition of artificial scarcity, in my view. I've been about every type of school over the years, and the best experience I had was in a Montessori school. I wish I had done that for a lot more. But, we just passed last year $50,000 for the first time ever as the average liberal arts for a four-year education. That's totally unsustainable. It's a bubble that's going to burst, and I hope that it does. I expect within 15 years that this whole system is going to collapse and there won't be anything remotely resembling the institutions we've been stuck with for the past couple hundred years that have grown up. If you think about this, Beethoven never went to any place like Juilliard. Michelangelo did not go to a design school. Jenner, who's the discoverer of this idea of doing vaccinations, a smallpox vaccine, he was actually apprenticed at the age of 13 to a doctor, and he went back to London and he talked to some farmers that noticed that their cows got sick and with the form of the virus in cattle, and that they were sort of protected from that. And this is an example of user innovation, right, where often people that are working closely in this area will have something that carries over. And so Jenner came up with this and figured out this principle behind vaccinations, that they could roll out defense against smallpox. He was able to do that in a very early age. So it's, you know, we thought the MIT is great that it's doing this with the open courseware, but it's kind of like we're applauding them for doing something they already should do. They basically do this all as an intranet anyway, internally. They always have the stuff for the students to share, so it doesn't cost them anything to just roll that out for the general public to do it. And we have to keep in mind here that the textbook monopoly is the big missing piece here for this industry. You have these, Google Books is trying to get all of the classic texts and stuff online, but they're still under copyright, so we can't, you know, a liberal arts education is basically just reading the great books, right? And all that should already be digitized and available for you, but it's not. So I would recommend everyone check out Werner Vinge's book, I believe it's called Rainbow's End. It looks at the future of education. He has a poet, the main character is a poet who's been revived. He's had Alzheimer's or something, but now they've cured it, so he's totally obsolete, and he has to catch up with this, you know, it's like 2030 or something, and he can barely keep up with the, quote, dumb or slow kids. He's having to learn to use wearable computers, and basically the idea of intelligence amplification. If I'm plugged into Google, you know, I'm about a zillion times smarter than I am otherwise, and we're still teaching people like geography when they don't need that at all. They need to be able to do mashups of Google Maps and learn how to integrate various data sources. And we talk about, oh, you're cheating if you get help. That's just nonsense. You know, in my everyday projects, right, my ability now depends on how many people I can mobilize in my network of collective intelligence to be able to solve different problems. So, I mean, there's no cheating. It makes, you know, we want to use every resource that's available to us, and we need to learn people skills and actually how to collaborate. And so this in this fictional future curriculum there, have a class on, you know, search and retrieval and how to integrate that and work on group projects together. So I think that is really the future of education, and I would think it's a good thing that if you read Neil Gershenfeld talks about how we don't have a mechanical literacy, that these blue-collar trades have been excluded from the liberal arts. And so this technological ability or the maker, you know, aspect has been neglected. I actually think that's good because it hasn't allowed academia to get a stranglehold on it. So he has done a calculation recently saying, well, MIT is expanding their campus X number of square feet and going to spend about $100 million to do that. And he only needs $1 million to seed this network of fab labs or community-based type libraries, essentially, to learn 3D printing. I think that really is the model that we have to embrace and get away from this artificial scarcity of prestige that essentially the institutions now.
Well, let me bring up another area where the scarcity is, I think, artificial, and where prestige could play a part in preventing or slowing the appearance of abundance. We're going to have to move quickly through this one because we do want to get to the dream world of abundance here before the show is over. But I was writing about the healthcare debate on the Speculus the other day, and I'm going to do the ultimate thing that a person can do when they have a blog and their own radio show. I'm going to read a section from my own blog. That's it. So here's what I wrote. The challenge is to greatly increase the number of solved medical problems. And the way to do that is through automation. Increasingly sophisticated computer technology can guide technicians or even patients through tests to reveal the appropriate course of treatment for increasingly complex problems. And I went on to say, I would guess that fewer than 20% of the problems that doctors routinely encounter account for 80% or more of the time they spend with patients, and that many of these would be good candidates for automating. Offloading 80% of the tasks doctors currently perform would be the equivalent of having five times as many doctors on hand to apply their expertise to the treatment and prevention of illness. So the total amount of medical care available would increase geometrically, and since the vast majority of this care would be automated, the total cost of care would plummet. But I would anticipate that among other factors that might slow us down, the fact that doctors would be very hesitant to see their job being done by computers, just as we all are, would be a major obstacle to that. Is the idea of an elite medical person who has to be there to, you know, prescribe the antibiotics a strong enough social barrier to keep us from getting there, or can we get to a world of healthcare abundance? And Joseph, since I'm with you, I'll give that one to you first.
Yeah, okay. We will eventually get there. I have been following this area quite intensely for the past 3-4 years and talking to various health 2.0 people that are trying to disintermediate this. And my dad, ironically, is a surgeon. They really have a certain mindset after decades of training, so they just can't fathom the fact that they're going to be essentially they're obsolete. You know, we don't have a mechanic for every piece of the car. You know, if we did, you had to go to somebody for the carburetor and the muffler, and we'd have a crisis for servicing our automobiles. And yet in medicine, we've got a different, you know, urologist for this and a pediatric urologist, even though it's the same system, right? So we're seeing it already with LASIK, for example. That's pretty much already automated. You program in the thing, and it zaps the eyes. More and more, you're having robot-assisted surgery. Personal genomics is coming online to hopefully allow you to just test yourself and essentially Google your genes, right? But there's immense, the profession of medicine is completely at odds with this. They don't know how to deal with patient empowerment at all. So it is a big clash of cultures.
Okay. So do we get the abundance of healthcare or no, Sally? What's your prognosis and when?
Oh, we definitely will. This is part of the accelerating technology. I just rewatched a tape I made of a series on the history of 20th century science and technology, and this one part of it was dealing with healthcare. What they went through in the early 20th century, having no idea how the plague spread until a few years later when some doctors in India figured out, or pellagra, which was a really nasty disease that struck a lot of people in the South. They had no idea it was a lack of niacin that caused it. Or what they went through, they showed on open heart surgery. How many years they had to figure out, how do we keep the patient alive when we open up the heart? And it finally came up
right
with a very crude heart-lung machine. But the thing was, the show was so illustrative of how it sped up over the 20th century, how much we've learned about how the body works and how diseases attack the body and how we can counteract that. And I'm predicting that the speed-up will continue with the development, which is going on right now, microscopic little machines going into the body and hauling things to cells to repair the genes or whatever. That will eventually get to the very tiny nanotechnology devices, which I call cell repair mechanisms, which will go into every cell in our body and make sure that all the organelles are working right and the DNA is properly replicated and everything's shipshape. So our cells will be young and happy, and we will be young and happy. I believe since information is becoming more democratic in the sense of being spread out more and more, I believe the same thing will happen in healthcare, where at a certain point, and I can't say exactly how or when, but I think it's coming in less than a generation, the doctors will no longer have a monopoly over medicine, because the people who really know their nanotechnology stuff will really know how to cure what ails us and keep us healthy and happy. I think that's the trend that we got to watch.
Of course, those people will effectively be the doctors at that point. I mean, to say they're not the doctors would not be exactly
accurate. Who knows? By a certain point, we all might be doctors. We might upload all the information ourselves and monitor our own bodies or whatever. But to say that we got to shift here and shift there as the health care debate rages on, this tiny, tiny pie that is almost like nothing, I'm projecting again from the trends I saw in that 20th century history. Really, what we got now compared to what we could have in 20, 40 years is absolutely a pittance. And I think trying to shuffle around the chairs and cut a little tiny pie is a waste of our time. We really, really got to push the technology hard.
Okay, well, and that's my point too. I want more pie. I'm a big pie fan. I want the biggest pie we can get. What do you say, Paul? Is the future of healthcare? We become our own doctors. We have tiny doctors swimming in our veins. We have robot pals who are taking care of us. What's the prognosis, doctor?
Probably all of the above in that regard, and at different time frames. Obviously, the smaller things, are probably going to take longer. The smaller they are, and the more effective they are. But certainly, there are a lot of things that we'll be doing presumably a lot sooner, and things that are happening even now. I mean, for example, healthcare is again an example of artificial scarcity in some ways. One of the reasons healthcare is so expensive in the United States is because it's very expensive to go through medical school, and one of the reasons for that is that the doctors who teach there are paid many hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to do that because of their expertise. And also there's a sort of artificial shortage of doctors because there's only so many medical schools and only so many people accepted and only so many people produced, despite vast numbers of people in our society being very interested in medical care, but they don't necessarily have the money to go through it, or they don't make the cut, whatever the limits are set. And a lot of these limits are kind of arbitrary because a lot of success in medicine has to do with doctor-patient relationships, not necessarily that they got the highest SAT scores or something like that. So in that sense, we already have a little bit of an artificial scarcity of doctors. And some of that's being addressed, like physician assistants even now, that we're getting more and more people who can do doctoring-type things, maybe under the supervision of a doctor. So there are a variety of these different trends. But in general, what is the cost of medicine? Well, you have the cost of people, you have the cost of the materials, like drugs and things, and you have the cost of all the tools. And certainly materials costs, you would think, would be going down as we can fabricate drugs and other things more quickly, ignoring for the moment issues about patents and copyrights. The cost of tools, if we can print them, are going to be going down. The cost of custom items, like custom hips, are going to be going down if we can print them in our 3D printers. And certainly the cost of education can be going down, not just from web pages about how to do some type of surgical procedure, but also simulators. For example, where you either learn directly with a simulation you use from the internet, or where you're actually doing a hands-on simulation that maybe, let's say, if you're using a surgical robot, you'll be able to work on a simulated patient. Already you can do that. I saw one video about that where they took a surgeon, they were showing how to use the robot, and they brought a butcher in, and they were showing him how to use the robot, and they were getting different feedback from the two people as they went through simulated surgery. So there are all these kind of new technologies for learning, and again, that that has the potential of increasing the number of people who can do these kind of things. But getting back to one thing Sally said about prestige, I think she's right on the great one of the best ideas there, which is that a lot of people do want to compete in that sense. I'm generally on Alfie Cohn's side of minimizing competition whenever possible, but it is an aspect of our makeup to some extent, and I think our challenge is to use people's competitive drive that they want to show off for status or mates or whatever, and try to have our society harness that and use it in a positive way. And one of my favorite books about this is James P. Hogan's Voyage from Yesteryear. I met him once in person at Princeton. The Science Fiction Society had brought him in for a talk. I hadn't read his book then, and I'd corresponded a couple times with him afterwards, but he's one of my favorite authors about some of these post-scarcity themes. And his science fiction book, Voyage from Yesteryear, has essentially a collision of a new post-scarcity culture and an old culture coming from Earth to kind of take them over. And one of the things that the culture from Earth can't really understand is that the new one has a kind of currency, but it's not money in any way we'd recognize, but it's kind of prestige or acknowledgement of expertise. And they said that for someone who grows up in that society, anybody trying to counterfeit that would be like somebody passing you a funny-looking $5 bill. You would just see it right away because you've learned so much about the social networking and stuff to understand this. And so as we move in that direction, you can imagine people getting to the point where, they'll be able to assess other people around them as far as their competency, either with social networking tools or just face-to-face. And so people have a better sense of of the competency of the medical practitioners around them, and so forth. I'm sure that there's a lot of things in that area that will be developed and refined and improved. But anyway, it's just fascinating that, you know, the topic that Sally mentioned, that there's a book, and there's probably other books as well, that kind of try to paint that picture, and it's a very interesting one.
Well, let's look at that world now. We're going to jump to the end. So here's what I'd like all three of our panelists to be prepared to do. I want to take a few moments and spend it in a world of abundance, a world of post-scarcity. And here's what I want to know about it. I'm assuming that it's along the lines of what Sally was talking about, where that we've all sort of skirted around, where nanotechnology, the ability to reproduce virtually any physical goods, food or anything else that you would need, has made it possible for essentially all material scarcity to have been eliminated. What's that world like? I've been following in the chat, and as we talked about education, there was I thought Harvey was raising some really interesting points about, yeah, but if we go to homeschooling, our kids going to get socialized. If we eliminate universities, people won't have the great experience of going away to college. So there's this as we talk about how things could be, how things that are in our current world could be removed. I fear we've given the impression of the post-scarcity world of being one that has less in it, has fewer choices and fewer things in it than the world that we're currently in, which obviously in my opinion is exactly the opposite of the case. So we'll start with you, Paul. Just take me to that world for a few minutes. What is it like? How is it run? Just tell me anything about living in that world that strikes your fancy.
Well, I do think it would be fairly diverse, and even to begin with, there might be worlds plural. So you can imagine that by the time we have more and more abundance, we're able to do things like create self-replicating space habitats that would duplicate themselves from asteroidal ore and sunlight with solar panels. So in that case, you might have these habitats that might each have populations of a million, or, you know, they might vary in size from smaller to bigger. This is all technology that was developed in the 70s and 80s, these ideas, I should say, not necessarily technologies. So we may actually see a variety of worlds with different kinds of governance structures. So one might be more market-driven, one might be more authoritarian, one might be, you know, a totally different possibility. So I think we'll see a variety of these possibilities of worlds, and that's something that this abundance makes possible, this radiation of diversity. So it's, I know that's a little bit of a weaselly answer, you know, as far as just thinking about one type of governance, but I do think we'll see a variety of possibilities in that area in general. As far as like what things might look like for schooling, the issue with homeschooling and socialization comes up all the time. And in fact, a lot of people pick homeschooling because they don't like the socialization that kids are getting in school, often with other kids who are very commercially driven, very absorbed with the television, very into fads, very into kind of the very negative girl culture that's grown up in around some schools, with a lot of cutting, you know, comments and so forth. And so a lot of people actually homeschool to get kids away from that. And one thing about homeschooling is it's often kind of family to family. So it's sort of peer to peer in that sense. You know, families meet other families and the interactions happen on that basis. So you don't necessarily have a central place that you might go. Although often people do create homeschool resources centers or some kind of regular meeting group or stuff or such. So what I'm trying to get at there is that even within homeschooling, you know, there's a diversity of possibilities. And that's, again, another example of this abundance. Once you have the time to think about things, you can often tailor them more to your unique needs. So, again, that's, you know, a diversity of education there, a diversity of possibilities. Some people in any system may fall through the cracks, but that's the situation where abundance can also help. Because right now, if you have neighbors who are very stressed out about money, neighbors who aren't around because they have to work to pay for things, then they can't be good neighbors or as good neighbors as if they were, you know, essentially retired millionaires living next door who were able to, you know, help out if you had a problem or such. So in that regard, the more that people have abundance in their lives, I think the more opportunities there are to just be there and to have put out a helping hand, to put out resources to help people who might otherwise be falling through cracks for one reason or another. So I guess I see that abundance can transform aspects of our society in that way. One thing I want to say on that, again, of this vision of the future, is that, and I know this is fast-forward radio, but sometimes we can learn a lot by rewinding. And even though I would say in some ways we're in scarcity times and maybe coming to the end of them, and we're talking about a post-scarcity future, there really was a pre-scarcity time. I don't want to over-romanticize, you know, the time 10,000 years before. But if you look at some basic facts like the size of skeletons, human skeletons were taller back then in Europe than any time till about the last 100 years. And you can even see that in suits of armor, where the average person now couldn't wear the suit of armor because it's made for a shorter person. So while it's quite true, and I know this was mentioned in one of your previous things, that people now may live better in many ways than a king 500 years ago, except not being able to invade France, I think you mentioned.
Which we don't really need to do.
If you go way, way back, 10,000
years.
Come
on now.
I'm sorry. To invade France.
If you go way, way back 10,000 years, you will find people who were taller, and that means they were eating better. They had better teeth that weren't having a lot of the problems we have now. There are a variety of things that have come about from agriculture, like malaria. That's one thing that's kind of co-evolved. Smallpox, which is created in part from people spending a lot of time around animals as a disease. And so what I'm trying to say is that there was a time that even though there was high infant mortality, there were various kinds of other parasites, there was warfare of various types, there were aspects of a pre-scarcity time. And you can even see that in a variety of stories among the Hmong. There's some older Dutch stories. Even if you look in the Bible, the story of Genesis, one of our homeschooler friends pointed this out to me, that you can read the very beginning of the story of Genesis as essentially the end of abundance and the creation of sort of scarcity and having to do agriculture. And when you think about the dynamics of it, it's possible that the hunter-gatherer lifestyle was so successful that it created this huge, huge population. And then that created a pressure to change to feed everybody. And so we had to move towards agriculture. But that's why the skeletons shrunk, because agriculture is not as nutritious generally, because there's fewer things in the diet. And the things that you have are more starchy and stuff, and so they're harder on the teeth, and they create all kinds of other
heart disease,
biological
so
problems.
Yeah. Diabetes and heart disease, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Diabetes, heart disease, so our biology hasn't quite adapted to our new lifestyle, our new diet. And so there are aspects of hunter-gatherers, the positive ones. I know there's lots of negative ones. But if you think about, like Marshall Salins wrote this book called an essay called The Original Affluent Society, and he talked about how when you have enough for what your needs are and your wants, you're kind of affluent. Now, we may have very high needs and wants now, but there's a lot of people who were content with less. They didn't expect more. And they only really had to work, some of the tribes he talked about, really a few hours a day. And that work wasn't like factory work like we're doing now. It was very engaging work with the mind and the hands and working in cooperation with other people oftentimes. So, you know, you got a lot of happy people who were socializing and dancing and telling stories, raising children, all those kind of things. So I think that to some extent, as we move into post-scarcity, a lot of the ideas from pre-scarcity are going to come back. People are going to have more time to do those things. Because one of the things that I think that Natasha had brought this up at the end of one of your other...
Now that would have been part one, actually. Yeah.
Right. She said some very profound stuff at the end on abundance, and she talked about how it's not just an abundance of stuff, you know, quantity and excess. And I think we, in some ways, have a lot of that already, too much in the U.S. for some people, not all. There's a lot of people missing out. But she talked about the issues of the quality of the stuff. You know, in her words, enough for a healthy, loving life. And I think that's very important, and that relates to my original thing about printers, that at some point I was like, I don't need another printer. You know, I want to focus on my kids.
You've got other interests in life.
I have
printer.
Other things. And yeah. I think if we go further, one could talk about things like an abundance of free time or, you know, kind of abundant distribution in at least a base that is a little more egalitarian, like with a basic income where everybody got the equivalent of $1,000 or $2,000 a month to spend in the market or something like that.
Well, in fact, you know, that speaks to one of the other objections that was raised there, which was, you know, I can't homeschool, and I need my kids to be in school because my wife and I have to work, which was one of the things that was brought up there. So I think the idea of recognizing abundance as meaning an abundance of time, of control of your own time, like ownership back of your own life, that's some compelling stuff. And I would say that we don't actually have to go back to the good old hunter-gatherer days. If anybody wants to, they can. But you really had me at retired millionaires. Okay. That one worked fine for me. Okay. Take it to you, Sally. Give me, in response to what Paul said, or your own thoughts very quickly on the life in the world of abundance.
Yes, I see we're running out of time. I had 12 conclusions, which there's no way I can read these. I'm going to pick out just a few. Say goodbye to jobs that involve working with forming manipulation of matter. Nanotech will take care of that. Say goodbye to businesses and jobs that are involved in office work. The information society that I'm dreaming of, the system itself will run all that information. Say goodbye to service work. Haircutting, food preparation, banking, stock brokering, marketing, all these will either be done for pleasure or will be just completely technologically obsolete.
If my boss is listening, I'll keep doing marketing for pleasure. No question about that.
Itself will completely disappear or will become an avocation, a really involving hobby. In other words, people will live where they want. They will do the hobbies, or if they call it a work, they'll do that. They'll homeschool their kids. Their kids will get together online, and maybe they'll go to something that I imagine for a science fiction story called Space University. It would be a space colony with an engine on the back, and it would loop around the solar system, and all these various scientists would be studying the solar system at various aspects. The students would be there to be learning and to be helping them, and they'd have a community there with other people as well, not just the scientists and professors and students. In other words, just imagine a really nifty scenario from science fiction or from your own imagination, and if people want to do it with the truly abundant nanotechnology society, they will be doing it.
Quick question from the chat room. How will service work go away, especially human-to-human services?
I believe that almost all of our services right now, we need humans to do them because no one else can do them. And that will not be true.
So who else besides human? You're not talking chimps. Where are we going?
We're talking about nanotechnology doing them.
So robots, basically. Yeah. Okay. I was going to give this to you, Sally, but we're almost out of time, so I'm going to throw this one to Joseph. Joseph, same question. Any additional thoughts you have on that? And just one additional thought. Do you think most people will work in that world, or will most people choose not to work?
No, I think we're going to abolish professions to allow people to pursue passions, and we'll essentially have 100% gainful unemployment.
Gainful unemployment, I love that.
I like the sound of that.
We're going to be able to benefit from the productivity that technology brings. The technology autonomously does work if it's properly deployed. So. And, you know, again, on that question of the service stuff, actually right now, you know, a lot of people might do stuff as a volunteer basis to do service because they enjoyed it if they didn't have to work. There's a good science fiction series, The Torture, by E&M Banks, looks at this whole post-scarcity world, and one of these people wipes tables, in his spare time simply because he likes to do that to as a form of service. And his other thing that he does is he publishes some obscure papers on, like, insects or something. So, and occasionally he'll do service just because it's good to, pitch in and do that for someone who appreciates, him having cleaned the table or whatever. So, I mean, there's all sorts of ways that it can work out in the future. And if we have to, we have some type of rotating draft type system thing all based on prestige, you know, that people serve. If it's an unpleasant thing, then we can think about how to motivate them that way. But yeah, obviously, we want to eliminate almost everything that's tedious to the extent that it's possible to do that. And the higher order thing of building the robot to then vacuum for you actually would be fulfilling enough, probably. And the maintenance on that robot perhaps won't be tedious. So that or you can have a robot that does the maintenance on the robot. So there's various ways of ascending the chain, so to speak, to where you get to a point where human expenditure of our effort is pleasant at that level, and hopefully you automate the stuff that we don't want to do.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to have to leave it. I love the notion of gainful unemployment. I've got a new goal in life. Thank you for that phrase, Joseph. Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Sally. What a terrific discussion. Enjoyed having all three of you on the program, and the time has gone by much more quickly than we would have liked. I think we could have spent another 90 minutes easy doing this, but my thanks to the panel for really a terrific discussion this evening. Stephen, very quickly, what's our music tonight?
Well, I thought I was going to demonstrate scarcity by not having music at all tonight, but Instead, we were able to upload right in the middle of the show some music, and it is Garden of Dreams by Sean Madden.
Garden of Dreams by Sean Madden. Thanks for getting that together, Stephen. Thank you for everyone who listened. Next week, Ray Kurzweil will be on to talk about the singularity. Look forward to being with you all then. Until then, live to see it.
Of the world, because I really don't think that's true. But I'm looking around and taking notes and reading all the signs that we're about to find out who is who. But some people try to hold on to the very thing that's killing them, and some people are trying to break free. And it's only a matter of time before we find out what's behind curtain number three. No matter what happens, I promise to keep on. Yeah, keep on creating, inventing, and celebrating life. Keep on waking up inspired and tending to the garden of my dreams. Tending to the garden of my dreams. Oh, 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 oh. Ooh, 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 yeah. Oh, well, this is not a protest song, and I'm not saying there's something wrong. I'm talking about the beauty of a well-lived life. That's what's going to make the difference for the world that's pulling at your soul. So let it take control. And no matter what happens, you've got to keep on. Yeah, keep on creating, inventing, and celebrating life. Keep on waking up and fighting, and tending to the garden of your dreams. Tending to the garden of your dreams. Whoa, 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 whoa. Something like that, something. You know there's something precious at the corner of your mind. The spark of life, the source of it all. Whether howling at the walls you raise and crawling at the moon, you better listen to it. It's dying. So I implore you to answer and save your own soul. And keep on creating. Yeah. waking up inspired, oh, and tending to the garden of your dreams, tending to the garden of your dreams. I'm wrong for singing conscious songs, but I should mind my own business and go. We'll just stop for a minute, take a look around, listen up a little bit, and you'll know you and me are on a one-path journey, no matter who you think you are. And it's my job, as far as I can see, to let you know you got all that you need to be free. You got all that you need to be free. You got all that you need to be free. All that you need to be free. You got all that you need to be free. Now that I've got your attention, let's talk about what there is to do. Go inside and ask yourself what you came here for and what will ultimately complete you. And then when you're afraid that all that's left is to do it well, then do it with everything you got. And when people try to tell you that you're shooting off the mark, well, say a prayer and give it everything you got. No matter what happens, you've got to keep on.